I think I should probably start off. It's January 2018. Happy New Year. Nice and cold outside. Certainly not very environmentally enriching. But I'm sure there's plenty of things that can be done. And I know we're probably going to get into some of the things as a recap on environmental enrichment. But this month's subject is going to be, I won't say specifically for the ladies out there, but a lot of what we're going to talk to Dr. Pete tonight about is related to female hormones. And whilst progesterone is not typically female, it is produced by males, progesterone as a topic of discussion for tonight will run through many of the disorders that we're going to cover. And some in particular, I wanted just to highlight again the difficulty. If you are looking online for information, I mean, the internet is an excellent source, but it's also a good source of disinformation. So you have to be really careful where you pick your narrative. Typically, clinical journals and clinical trial published information is also it's also skewed. It's not always, you can't always take it on face value that that result is actually what happened. So we're going to get into a couple of instances where some very prominent peer-reviewed trials with thousands of people, I mean, huge cohorts of people that were involved in these trials to try and demonstrate an effect. And particularly with regard to progesterone, the effects of progesterone on traumatic brain injury are one of those things we're going to look at. And then we're going to look at things like the effect on cognitive impairment. We're going to look at the effects on Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative disorders. And then postpartum depression and epilepsy, menstrual-related epilepsy, catamenial epilepsy, and then sleep apnea. So I'm sure from a perspective of postpartum and progesterone for the women who have had maybe PMS symptoms or estrogen excess symptoms, which are going to be very much tied to tonight's discussion, who suffer with polycystic ovaries, you know, what they call breast mice, so cysts, cystic formations, obviously endometriosis, and then difficulty conceiving. So if those females that are listening, if it's pricked your interest, there's a lot that can be done about this. I graduated 20 years ago now with an honours degree in herbal medicine, and I've worked with Dr. Pete here for the last 9 to 10 years. And a lot of what we found out from Dr. Pete has been pretty revelational, because when I was studying herbal medicine in England, even the medical literature, and we were trained by doctors and endocrinologists and pathologists and all the other ologists, but they all came out of a medical background. We weren't really taught by holistic practitioners, apart from maybe the materia medica side of the education. So we were taught by doctors, and we had gynecologists and physiologists and pathologists. So, but they have the same kind of medical background, and a lot of the things we learned, I've later found out from Dr. Pete and from doing research online, looking to see deeper, there actually is quite a lot of untruth in what we were told as is what's good for you. So hopefully these shows are all online. Our website, which is www.westernbotanicalmedicine.com, there's a resource tab. And every one of the shows that we've recorded with Dr. Pete here since 2008 are there. I think there may be the last 1 or 2 months have yet to be put up, but essentially it's a great resource and it's free. So people should definitely go there and look at that. And then obviously Dr. Pete's website, and he's very much somebody I want to support fully. His website is referenced with lots of articles. All of these articles, I should say, are fully referenced. So his specialty, I'll just introduce him here in a second, and he can just give you his bio. But I know people that are listening who probably tuned in just for the show know him, but there's always people that I come across who've not heard him before. And so obviously he's a great resource to further learn and relearn some untruths that we've been brainwashed with. So I see the engineer's talking to somebody. I don't know if he's talking to Dr. Pete or not. Let me just see if he's there.
I'm here.
Oh, hi, Dr. Pete. Well, thanks so much for joining us again. And I, as always, I know some people have mentioned on the forums that, you know, your bio, they've heard it all before. But you know what? There's people that haven't heard you. So I'm just going to carry on and as usual and please ask you to give a background, your academic background and your research since then.
My PhD study was at the University of Oregon in 1968 to 72. My dissertation was on reproductive aging, and my intention when I went back to graduate school in biology was to study the brain, but I found that the brain research was the most doctrinaire next to genetics, and so I looked around and found that the reproductive physiology was actually oriented towards science. And my background before that had been studying literature, linguistics, and painting. And it's probably the background in literature that made me think in an adversarial manner in evaluating science rather than an authoritarian, except because the professor said it's true. I think the legal attitude of looking for truth by an adversarial approach should apply to medicine and science in general.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good. So as I was preparing material, excuse me, for this evening's show, I was looking at initially, I wanted to ask you kind of go through a list of disorders that I have that will all be found to be linked, but didn't necessarily want to bounce around all of them in describing one at a time. And I started off with looking at the evidence, again, wanting to be, just like you, very scientifically oriented here and looking for truth in science and wanting and expecting good science to reveal the truth, which it will do impartially. And it's a reproducible event, which is a defining marker of good science. About traumatic brain injury, and I never actually realized that the numbers were so huge, the amount of people actually suffering with traumatic brain injury, whether these are people that play in professional soccer or boxing or people that get in auto wrecks or people that fall off of, you know, buildings and ladders and the numbers are pretty staggering, and actually, it's been one of the most difficult to treat conditions. I mean, we never really think, I never thought about it really too much until I started plunging into the papers around the subject. But traumatic brain injury is not very well treated, and whilst there have been some very good phase one and two trials using progesterone, which is going to be the topic of tonight, woven in many different diseases or pathologies, that although the trial one and two trial results were very promising and they spurred the phase three trials, which had huge numbers, cohort numbers of 10,000 in one of them and 1,000 or 1,500 in the other, both of these studies, and we'll go on to describe them so people can take a look at it themselves, both these studies seemingly found no benefit. Now, I know you've described at length the anti-inflammatory and anti-edema, to mention just a couple of the effects of progesterone. But the swelling that occurs in traumatic brain injury is one of the main contributors of all the damage, along with, of course, with all the leakage and the inflammatory cytokines that are released as a process of cell breakdown and rupture. So given that, the phase one and two trials were so promising and spurred the call for a phase three trial, I read both of the most recent ones, the PROTECT 3 and the SYNAPSE trial on progesterone for severe traumatic brain injury, saying that there was no beneficial effect when And we'll bring this out in a little bit after you've described perhaps your understanding of progesterone and how you definitely would advocate progesterone for swelling. And then we'll go you know, bounce around the production, the endogenous production of progesterone, because it's very, very different to estrogen, for example, being produced in the CNS and the brain cell, astrocytes and oligodendrocytes, as well as gonads, etc. So the main study here showed no benefit, and it's almost just yet another, gosh, just another closed door, if you like. I find more and more as I talk to you and as I look at papers myself that they're really, and I went, you know, the word conspiracy is thrown around so much, I know, but there does seem to be a real work to undo progesterone's good, because in the study, given they did a 120-hour study, for this particular application of progesterone, they said there was no benefit in reducing swelling or outcome. But a later piece of work that was done when both of these phase 3 trials didn't seem to show any benefit was refuted by a professor of working for the Emory University. He's basically just been studying brain trauma for the last 20, 30 years, so it's his specialty. He's actually revealed some of the faults of the study that are definitely noteworthy. So I was going to start the questioning here to you in terms of progesterone and its beneficial effects. How do you interpret this this negative effect that was shown in the trials, in comparison to truly what progesterone is capable of doing?
There have been, I think it was about 15 big studies on brain injury. And interestingly, after overwhelmingly promising results from, for example, using intravenous magnesium to reduce swelling and restore metabolism, all of these, by the time they reached the phase 3 level, suddenly the results were the opposite, and nothing turned out to be beneficial for treating human brain trauma, even though the previous smaller studies and many, many animal studies were showing overwhelming good increased survival, increased full recovery, and so on. And the fact that something happens at the phase 3 level, I think, is very suspicious when the government and big corporations get involved. I suspect that they really are protecting drugs that are not generic the way progesterone is. Urea, I don't think there has ever been a major study of treating brain trauma with simply intravenous urea. But it has had just amazingly good results. And I think probably a serious study could be done using all of the known beneficial things, urea, magnesium, progesterone, hypertonic saline solution, and so on. I think if you do everything that's known to be beneficial to the brain, you would get even better results than with a single drug-like treatment. Mm-hmm. The worst thing about this big PROTECT study, I think, was that they not only didn't give a big enough dose, mm-hmm. But they gave it emulsified with, I think, it was intralipid, a soybean
right.
oil.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the amount of soybean emulsion that they were giving intravenously in animal studies, it in itself is harmful.
Yeah, it was a 6% solution.
I think it was about 1970, someone injected an emulsified soy oil into rats and showed that on the first pass through the brain, 17% of the oil was taken up into the brain. There's no blood-brain barrier that functions against oil. And then they dissected the brain and showed that, one dose of oil was enough to alter the morphology of brain cells.
Yep.
So intravenous treatment with something supposedly beneficial with a known
poofer,
toxin to the brain with a long history of evidence, it's hard to imagine how corporate and government interest putting millions of dollars into the project could have been that ignorant.
Yeah. Okay, and the other thing I noticed from that trial, you mentioned the 6% soybean oil that they used. They were only using 2 milligrams of progesterone per milliliter for the active treatment, and then the drug infusion was started intravenously with a loading dose of 0.71 milligrams per kilo body weight per hour for 1 hour, followed by 0.5 milligrams per kilo per hour for the rest of the 119 hours. So they were getting two, and I'd like you to put this in perspective for people that are listening, because maybe people don't quite understand the normal values that people, females are exposed to during the menstrual cycle and or pregnancy. So two milligrams of progesterone per mil, so basically half a milligram per kilo per hour for 120 hours. So would you put either half a milligram or 2 milligrams in perspective of the progesterone exposure that most females enjoy?
Some people have reported that in the last week or two of a healthy pregnancy, a woman's placenta is producing 800 or 900 milligrams of progesterone per day.
Right.
And that doesn't do anything potentially harmful. It's very protective. Women generally feel great the last 2 or 3 weeks when their progesterone is at a maximum. So they could easily have given 2,000 milligrams of progesterone per day instead of a few hundred milligrams.
Right. Well, this was 2 milligrams. So, yeah, 2 milligrams per hour. Okay, crazy. So that brings me on to the next thing. And it took a long time to find this because there's a lot of information, re-repeated information, information that people are quoting from this same study to say that progesterone is not effective for traumatic brain injury. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, and very little actual pro-supportive evidence for progesterone's anti-inflammatory effect and brain edema decreasing effect. But one person in particular, this particular doctor who was studying this at Emory University, and his name is Donald Stein, he published a couple of articles back in 2013 when he was very hopeful that this phase 3 trial was going to show very positive results for progesterone. And I think it took maybe 18 months to 2 years afterwards for him to publish this latest paper in the Journal of Neurotrauma, dated June 1st, 2017, and it's titled Suboptimal Dosing Parameters as Possible Factors in the Negative Phase 3 Clinical Trials of Progesterone for Traumatic Brain Injury. And it's about a 4-page article basically refuting the dose that was given. And as you mentioned, the emulsifying agent, the polyunsaturated fat that was used, the soybean oil that was used as part of a carrier, certainly bringing its own negative inflammatory effects. And you've always talked about PUFAs as being pro-estrogenic, and estrogen obviously is a known waterlogger, both of neurons and cells. And so all of this is working against any tiny dose of progesterone that was part of the trial. So just again, for people that are listening, it's very difficult sometimes to wade through all this material and find the facts, because a lot of it is being promoted by pretty vested interests that are plugged into many different levels of academia, with people doing follow-up research to get their PhDs, etc. And we all know from what you've mentioned and from personal experience for people that have been in academia that there is this real egocentric mentality running through the departments, and obviously funding that runs through those same mentalities, that people don't want to give up And so it's very difficult sometimes to find objective truth, but it is out there. And so that's what this show's been around for a long time, is to have you on the show and get you to refute what have been believed innocently, I think, for the longest time, because we've been taught it and we think these people are telling the truth. But your research shows otherwise.
You mentioned the estrogenic effect of polyunsaturated fats. When there's a trauma, the toxicity of the polyunsaturated fats is tremendously amplified by their conversion to the pro-inflammatory prostaglandins. And in any trauma, not just trauma, but any harmful experience of an organism, estrogen is produced in the injured tissue and in the whole organism. It can be sunburn or parasites in the intestine or broken bone, X-ray treatment, any harm you can think of due to the organism is going to increase the estrogen production and the conversion of polyunsaturated fats to the pro-inflammatory mediators.
Right. So this is what you would term, or literature would term, the excitotoxic situation.
That's part of it. That's an even more specific part that happens under the influence of estrogen and polyunsaturated fats. That they activate the glutamatergic transmitters in the brain, these literally excitatory signals, to the point that they become toxic. Progesterone opposes all of these, not just direct anti-estrogen effect, but it blocks the formation of prostaglandins, blocks the release of the stored polyunsaturated fats, blocks the formation of other inflammatory mediators, and antagonizes the glutamatergic excitotoxins. A function of the organism you can think of that's harmed by trauma is intensified by estrogen and polyunsaturated fats, and those are blocked by progesterone.
Okay. All right. So you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor, KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM. From 7:30 until the end of the show, 8 o'clock, people are invited to call in with questions either related or unrelated to this month's subject of progesterone and its treatment for traumatic brain injury. We're going to look at cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's, going to touch on that a little. Postpartum depression is quite interesting from a female perspective, postpartum. Catamenial epilepsy, which is a menstrual cycle related epilepsy, and sleep apnea, and how progesterone and CO2 have interrelated effects. So the number, if you're in the area, is 923-3911, or if you're in the outside area, or indeed out of the States, which has happened many times, there's an 800 number, 1-800-568-3723. So we will take your calls from 7:30 on. I saw the lights flashing here just a bit ago. I don't know if you've got anybody on at this point. No, maybe not. Maybe taking questions. Okay, we can always go back to him if he's there. Okay, he's there. Let's take this first caller. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question?
My name is Jeff from New York. I was listening to the comment about progesterone, and progesterone is, I guess, the miracle product. Does it only apply to women? Because I think you've mentioned in the past that pregnenolone is sort of universal, but progesterone men have to be careful about. And I'm not talking about like a 25-year-old. I'm talking about like a 55 to 70-year-old, where the risk of endotoxins is increasing just with basic age. So that's one question that I had. The other one is with regard to salt and insomnia. I was actually using sea salt, and I switched over, having read your forum, to canning salt, or actually kosher salt, which is pure salt, doesn't have any other minerals in it.
Okay.
And I actually think it really helped, and I'm just wondering if you would agree with that and sort of why, because I don't seem to be waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning anymore. I seem to be able to sleep through the night. So it might not be the only item, but Anyway, that was the second question. Thank you.
Okay. I'll let Dr. Pete ask the progesterone, answer the progesterone question with men and progesterone. How safe is it? But I will quickly just say the whole thing about salt and natural salt and Himalayan salts and deep earth crystal salts, the fact is they do contain a lot of other trace elements and other negative material. And I think that could be in part why there may be disruptions going on a hormonal level in a type of endocrine fashion with very small picogram concentrations of very questionable heavy metals and other products that can be present in the salt. So all of those colored salts and Himalayan salts, etc., typically have other particles within them that are not beneficial. And so I think just like Dr. Pete's talking about white sugar being good. It's not opposed to white sugar at all. And I think you find the caramelization product of any organic or brown sugars may be more detrimental than just straight white sugar for its own sake. But
So you use kosher salt? Do you agree that kosher salt and canning salts are the same, and that's the product that would be most efficacious for this type of program?
Yeah, I would say that a straightforward white sea salt. Again, you know, I have to question that because sea salt has its own, elements within it that we know are not particularly good for you. But a white sea salt is particularly what we use.
What do you think about iodine?
Not a good product to supplement with. Obviously, in terms of any Fukushima fallout or that kind of thing, and obviously there's a rationale for it for getting it taken up into the thyroid gland so that the radioactive material doesn't collect there. But Dr. Pete, what do you think about progesterone in men?
Well, first I'd like to comment that my interest in salt supplementation was related to the estrogen issue because I saw premenstrual women restricting their salt and making their symptoms worse. And I suggested to a friend that she salt her food to taste, and suddenly she didn't retain water. Salt was acting as a diuretic. Yeah. And then years later, I knew old people who were restricting salt and developing serious insomnia and not improving their blood pressure. So I suggested the same thing to them. And again, they went to sleep, got good sleep suddenly, and their blood pressure actually came down. Then I realized that Tom Brewer, with his diet for pregnant women in the 1950s and 60s, had seen the same thing, that some people he collaborated with supplemented pregnant women with toxemia symptoms, mm-hmm, with huge amounts of salt daily, and their toxemia essentially was cured. That's Shanklin and Hoden's book. The progesterone, I used it myself in the after I had worked with it in aging animals. I tried it on my own migraines, and twice in having a very intense migraine, I had complete reversal of the symptoms in from 1 to 2 minutes, from a total migraine to total wellness after ingesting about 100 milligrams, I guess it was. That was what really got me interested in describing it to other people. When I took too much for too long, I noticed that it had the effect of a cold shower for a day or two, an anti-testosterone effect, but that passes quickly when you stop taking it. And I found as I got older that I could tolerate 5 milligrams or 10 milligrams a day without that anti-testosterone effect. Several people have told me that it actually seems to reinforce their testosterone. And I think that works because testosterone, when you're under stress, is being converted to estrogen. And if you stop that conversion with progesterone, like aspirin, inhibits the conversion of testosterone to estrogen. You can actually raise your testosterone by blocking that conversion of stress.
That's very interesting. The question on iodine a moment ago, I know you've mentioned that, you know, taking a very small amount, or even a seemingly small amount, could be toxic. But that was in an experiment. So as you probably have written and incredibly articulately, and I don't want to make this political comment, but clearly the fluoridation of the water is something that Americans just literally can't escape.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, outside the laboratory, does more iodine make sense in the context of an environment where you're so exposed to fluoridated water that you can't really escape it? Does it counteract it and maybe would suggest more than a small dose to offset the fluoride that you're probably consuming without your knowledge?
I've never seen a test of that idea. I think it should be tested. When I spent some time in San Francisco without thinking about the fluoridation of water there, I was using a daily supplement of T3, Cytomel, and within a few days, I developed a migraine, which made me assume it was a sudden crash of my thyroid function. And so I looked up the interaction. If you take T3 with fluoridated water, if it's in your stomach at the same time, the amount of fluoride in the water will totally knock out the dose you're taking. But I think there is some effect once it gets in your body, as long as it's circulating as ionic fluoride. I think it will knock out any T3 that it runs into.
That's great. I have just one last question, if I may. On amino acids, you say, like gelatin, you're better off taking gelatin because that's how you get your proline and your glycine. It's more bioavailable and cleaner without any additives. But there are some isolated amino acids like taurine, which I think in and of itself may be extremely therapeutic and perhaps reduces stress. And the other one that I was interested in is carnosine, not carnitine, which you've written well on, but carnosine seems to be in a long list of benefits. Do the possible risks of additives, are they potentially offset by the fact that those two particular amino acids have a laundry list of benefits?
Yeah, I don't discourage people from taking those if they want to try them, but I don't use them myself.
Okay, well, yeah, okay. Okay, so, and one last question. I am holding my breath for 2 minutes at the best with my take a breath, and you let all the air out, and you hold it for a minute and a half. My maximum is 2 minutes. And then you take one breath in, and you hold it for a minute to a minute and a half. When I do that, sometimes I can do it better than others. It seems that might be a good proxy for bag breathing or swimming or whatever to increase your CO2. And is that something that if you practice it over a period of time as an older person, you can reduce the systemic stress to your body, as opposed to putting your whole body in a bag of CO2 gas?
Holding your breath does have its value, but the amount of time you hold it depends on your metabolic rate. If you have a high thyroid function, you might be unconscious after a minute of breath holding.
So if you have a high metabolic rate or low?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a high metabolic rate and are producing CO2 and consuming oxygen very fast, the fall-off of oxygen supply to your brain is going to be twice as fast as the average person and four times as fast as a hypothyroid person. So if you have a high metabolic rate, you don't want to force yourself to go 2 minutes.
Is there a good average for someone who's like modestly hypothyroid? I mean, as you get older, everyone becomes hypothyroid, right, to some extent. So, I mean, not to pin you down, but like doing it a minute a day, you know, is that a good target, like 30, 60 seconds? Because it's not easy. It's just something you can do and seems to certainly feel relaxed afterward. I mean, you feel like your blood vessels literally are relaxed. It's very odd feeling. I mean,
a very high proportion of the population is breathing too fast, hyperventilating. And right. So it's beneficial for most people to hold their breath or breathe slower to some extent, but there's no way without doing an oxygen consumption test that you can tell exactly how many seconds you should hold it.
Gotcha. But I think that's a good point. If you're doing it and you reduce the number of breaths you take during, you know, a normal minute without thinking about it, then you've improved. There's some benefit,
yeah.
Right? Because you're taking fewer breaths per minute.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call. We do have another caller on the line waiting to get on in, so let's make sure they get the opportunity. You're on the air. Where you're from? What's your question?
Yes. Hi. This is I'm calling from Finland. Always very grateful for your show and you know, just learning so much. My question is unrelated to this week's topic. It's basically prompted by a recent book in French by a doctor who founded the Oxidative Stress College. And so I'd like to know if this whole white fat, brown fat thing is good science. What I found in the book, which just came out recently, this is why I dare to mention it, is basically the assumption from this doctor that, you know, you cannot get rid, or it's almost impossible to get rid of white fat. You just accumulate it. And the only one thing that they mention would be to use cold. But I know that in past shows, it has been told that, you know, the stress created by applying cold, you know, makes it almost worse than not applying it. So this would be one of the questions. And my other question is, I've seen a study, basically it's on mice, so I don't know if it's applicable, if it's good science either for men, but that also goes as far to say that starvation or fasting, actually not starvation, fasting would actually reverse the thing. So basically turn good brown fat into bad white fat. So any opinions on this would be appreciated. Thank you again.
So Dr. Pete, what do you have to say about brown versus white fat? I mean,
there is a lot of good, interesting research on that. And my orientation to it is that the activation of T3, the active thyroid hormone, is the crucial thing, and that, yes, stress will, prolonged fasting is going to have a lot of harmful, counterproductive effects. Mm-hmm. And one of those is that it knocks out the T3 in the various tissues. Even though the T3 that circulates in the bloodstream is two-thirds of it, roughly, is produced in the liver and about a third in the thyroid gland. But the various tissues of the body, muscles, skin, kidneys, brain, all of the tissues that have been studied are able to produce T3 from T4 locally as to supplement whatever can get in from the bloodstream, so that even if your circulation isn't delivering enough T3, your tissue is able to produce it itself. And the crucial factor for producing it locally in the tissue, it's partly glucose, but fructose seems to have a special ability to activate that tissue local production of T3. And so I would say that eating enough sugar, having your orange juice and other fruit regularly throughout the day is much better than either chilling yourself or starving yourself.
Okay.
And may I just ask one more thing, just
go ahead.
Very quickly. If you, you know, if you were to choose a place to live just based on trying to get your metabolism high, would it be safe to say that you would choose a high altitude, warm, the warmest place at high altitude, or...
Yeah, like
am
Peru.
I getting this one right?
Somewhere in Peru on a maybe 12 to 14,000 foot elevation
okay.
near the equator.
How about Mauna Loa,
gotcha.
Dr. Pete?
I don't know how high it is.
I think it's about 8 or 9,000.
Oh, yeah, I like like Toluca, Mexico.
there
you
go.
Little chilly, but I really feel exhilarated at that altitude, and I think it's better to be a little higher, 12,000 or so.
Probably less chance of getting bombed by the Koreans, too. Anyway, thanks for your call, caller.
Thanks you very much for taking my call.
Okay, so for people who'd like to call in, the 800 number is 1-800-568-3723. Dr. Raymond Peet sharing his wisdom with us, going through the motions of how progesterone is demonized time and time again, both in the literature and by corporate scientific interests. So Dr. Peet, I wanted to talk about the GABA receptor, the GABA-A receptor in particular. I know that this is the receptor which progesterone and its metabolite, allopregnanolone, which apparently is one of the more active metabolites, but that may just be hearsay too. I don't know what you have to say about allopregnanolone. These bind to the same GABA receptor, producing that anxiolytic, that kind of calm, peaceful type nervous response, because they block the excitatory stimulation. And that valeriana officinalis, common valerian, does just that. And I remember very clearly some of our first materia medica that was taught to us about valerian and GABA receptors and chloride channels, etc., and how the whole exotation is calmed down. So in terms of the GABA channel, GABA receptor, and progesterone or allopregnanolone's activity, do you think the metabolite is more active than progesterone per se, or do you think progesterone itself is still a good anxiolytic and calming agent? We talked about anti-inflammatory, anti-edema.
Since pregnenolone, the precursor for progesterone, itself is pro-GABA, I suspect that progesterone in itself is, but it is converted, reduced chemically, to form allopregnanolone, and that seems to be the most powerful activator of the GABA system in the brain.
Right.
But I think all of them are acting in the same direction. And besides acting to reduce stress and excitation by activating GABA, progesterone also inhibits several of the excitatory processes, including the glutamatergic and NMDA receptor systems.
Wow. Okay, we do have another caller, so let me hold your train of thought there before I question you some more. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from, and what's your question?
Buffalo, John.
Buffalo, New York? Two callers from New York one night.
Yeah, I had a question about the spine. So if someone has a disc herniation, so it either dries up or the gel breaks through, is it practically possible to regenerate that particular gel? Because I know you've mentioned, I think it's some studies that have been done where people have seen regeneration of different parts of the body, although it sounds crazy, but it seems like you said it's been done. So is it possible for the space between the disc vertebrae to regenerate?
Dr. Peet, what do you think about that, with that nucleus pulposus? Do you think that's possible to regenerate that? I'm sure you do, but...
Yeah, I know people get well from it, but I've never seen X-ray evidence
right.
They actually spaced out the distance between the vertebrae. I don't know whether the bones themselves can adjust, so I think it would be possible for the disc to rebuild itself and for the bones to conform themselves to the regenerating cartilage disc.
Yeah, I'm sure you'd probably advocate the use of progesterone in and of itself for
and thyroid.
Yeah,
I've heard and seen knee joints and shoulder joints that were making noise and causing relative immobility to the person to heal themselves in from an hour to overnight, a completely functionless knee recuperated to the point that the guy had to come to the house just to run up and down my stairs to show what had happened to his knee.
Well, this is a sort of a testimony. I've had 6 knee operations and 3 herniated discs, and I'm over 60. And by being on your diet and mitigating PUFA primarily and trying to do the other stuff that you talk about, I almost have no pain. I must say, though, the red light is my go-to thing. If things go bad, the red light kind of just eliminates pain almost immediately.
Yeah, I
can't say that for the other products you speak about, but I believe the progesterone. I just don't know much about it, but
Have you ever tried applying a progesterone-based oil to that area on your spine where you say you have a herniated disc? Have you tried that? And I don't know if you're using aspirin as anti-inflammatory, as an anti-inflammatory compound to reduce swelling. Obviously, that's a primary importance during that type of repair.
It's funny you mention that because I did run today and I literally put a paper towel in that aspirin solution that Dr. Pete had previously suggested. So I do that. I do believe it doesn't just help locally, but I think based on what I've read in his aspirin articles, it actually helps systemically, you know, body temperature, metabolism. It's just like aspirin is kind of an unappreciated product, as you've well documented. But no, I've never tried progesterone on the spine, but I remember in one of your programs, I believe, or another one, that Dr. Pete said you can put progesterone on like a mole, or maybe you were talking about that, or DHA, and you put
adjacent.
It like near a mole, and it moved around and eventually got better. Is that also possible?
Putting it next to the mole, the pigment cells are extremely mobile. They can, if your skin is warm, like in summer, they can travel through your skin close to an inch per day. And if you know what they're looking for, depending on whether it's on your forehead or your wrist or your chest, if you put it in the right place, they will apparently satisfy their need for the progesterone or DHEA and go back to where they should be to keep your hair pigmented, for example.
So the mole just kind of breaks up because the pigment
doesn't
clump together?
They congregate because they're deprived of something where they came from. For example, on my temple, I applied, I forget which it was, DHEA or progesterone on the front side. And the next day, there was a ring of pigment cells nearly an inch to the backside. The mole itself had shrunk. The second day, I applied another dab in front of it. And the following day, it was like a bullseye, 2 brown rings spaced out in a curved line behind it. And the mole itself was again smaller. And I kept doing that. And within a few days, a red, shiny blood vessel appearance constricted the base. It had been as big as a dime. And it constricted down to about the diameter of a matchstick and then dried up and fell off and didn't leave a scar.
Wow.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Andrew had mentioned about GABA, and so that just sparked a question based on his comment. Is GABA something you can take as a supplement, or does that mess up the rest of your neurotransmitters? Because I know people say
it is offered as a supplement.
B6 and get your dopamine up, but that doesn't that mess up the balance? How do you deal with that?
In animal studies, when they gave it to a healthy animal, none of it seemed to get into the brain. But if the animal had been sleep deprived, so its brain really needed GABA and was in an excited state, then the GABA was able to get in the brain and relax it.
Okay, we do have another caller, so let's make sure we get this. Thanks for your caller, I don't mean to cut you off
but
we do have another one. And where are you from, and what's your question?
Dr. P, hello. My name's Chris. I'm calling from Garberville, California, in southern Humboldt County. I've tried something called monk fruit sugar, which maybe you'd be familiar with.
No, hadn't heard of it.
Okay, monk fruit sugar is a melon, and it comes from southern China. I recently found out about it, and about 3 months ago I purchased 2 pounds of it, and I stopped eating table sugar entirely, granulated white table sugar, thank goodness, and brown table sugar. Went to this organic product, tried it, ate like a pound and a half of it over a month, just, you know, putting it on cereal and et cetera. And all the pain in my body, I think from the sugar inflammation, absolutely disappeared, including like the toes and extremities. I'm 63 years old. I'm a big guy, but I'm in the process of losing a considerable amount of weight. And why I'm telling you about monk fruit sugar is I seem to be progressively losing weight. I'm interested in knowing about the anti-inflammatories. I also have been promoting stevia sugar on another radio station in San Francisco called KGO about 15 years ago. And it's kind of taken over in America because of its anti-inflammatory, low glycemic index, actually zero glycemic. Monk fruit sugar, if you go online and look at it, zero glycemic. It's almost exactly like white table sugar, tastes the same. But it's zero glycemic, so any diabetics out there might want to try monk fruit sugar, which you can buy at local health food store. It's more expensive, but boy, talk about prevention and a pound of cure and all that. What do you think of this?
Have you heard of this product, Dr. P?
The effect that I was describing of ordinary sucrose, for example, in orange juice, is able to stimulate weight loss by activating the T3 in your fat cells. So fructose is available at health food stores in the pure form. If a person is diabetic, that doesn't increase the blood glucose the way...
Are you still with me?
Yep.
Okay. Why I'm telling you about this monk fruit sugar, M-O-N-K fruit sugar, is that it's zero glycemic. It seems to go in, and everybody in America, everybody in the world has eaten table sugar over a lifetime.
But what does it contain? What sugar does it contain?
I don't know. It's a melon, but I don't know what the constituencies of it is. I think it's mixed with erythritol, which is the stevia product. But the monk fruit, when I purchased it and ate it, and it's been about 2 months now, I have absolutely no problems with inflammation. It seems to have neutralized the inflammation. I have, after that 2 months were over, I started eating white table sugar again, organic brown sugar. And it absolutely has negated the effect, all the inflammatory effects of that white sugar as I've been eating it. I was doing my own experimental study. So I've been telling everybody about it that's overweight that they should go from eating granulated cane sugar, table sugar, to this monk fruit sugar that's in melon form and zero glycemic.
Well, I'd be interested to know what constituents it has. As far as stevia is concerned, I think it's a pretty toxic product. And like xylitol and all the other sugar substitutes, I do believe that there's a lot more negative effects to them than any positive effects from any lower calories or insulin sensitivity type reactions from their non-sugar sugar. But I've never, I know there's lots of information out there that will say that sugar's toxic or it's pure, white and deadly, etc. And we've totally visited it, and I don't think there's any mileage in it. Not too sure why it is that you would have had your inflammation clear up, but it's good that you did. Who knows what else is going on with you, with your thyroid, etc. You said you were pretty large. I don't know if you have any metabolic issues, maybe have some low thyroid situation happening with you, but typically those situations there do predispose to toxin buildup, and that obviously has its effects, as does weight on the joints. So I think all of those things kind of work against you. But yeah, happy that you got a reduction in your inflammation. But anyway, Dr. Pete, thank you very much for joining the show again. Appreciate your time so much. And we didn't get through much this evening, but I appreciate the callers that called. Perhaps we'll carry on next month and then go on to another topic from there.
Okay, very good.
Thanks for your time. Okay, so for people that have tuned into this evening's show, for you placed calls, thanks for your calls and input. For people that want to find out more about Dr. Pete, www.raypete.com, fully referenced scientific articles that have been produced and plenty of information and references to back up what he's saying. Again, for those people who have listened to the show this evening, the first part I was mentioning about the use of progesterone in traumatic brain injury, do take a look at those two studies. One, excuse me, was the Synapse study. And the other one was the Protect 3. Read them. I mean, they seem to show that there is no benefit. And yet, Dr. Donald Stein has produced a paper here in 2017 in the Journal of Neurotrauma. He's been a brain specialist for 30 years. That's all he's done. And his paper here, I think, outlines quite clearly the shortfalls of the study, and that actually progesterone is a very good model for treating this kind of disorder. So there's certainly hope there, and progesterone's got a lot of other benefits that we didn't get into. I know we've mentioned it on other shows, but certainly not the product that the industry would like to tell you it is, because it's actually estrogen. So again, things back to front. Well, thanks for joining us, and till 7 o'clock next third Friday of the month, from 7 to 8 p.m. My name's Andrew Murray. If anybody wants to reach us, we have an 800 or 1-888 number. It's 1-888-WBM-HERB, or through our website, which is westernbotanicalmedicine.com. So see you next month.